Have a listen to this song and tell me if you know who's coming up next. Folks, I think we're on the phone with Paul Michael Glazer, and I think he's going to tell his dog to shut up. But I'm intrigued to know what's going on at this particular moment.
I'm back. Are you there?
Well, yes. We just thought, you know, you and Kirk Cameron disappeared in the rapture.
No.
Oh.
So where was I?
Well, we were talking about the core of faith is trying to get back to that feeling of oneness.
Yes, oneness of belonging. Belonging. When we find these, it gets a little complicated because I'm fragmented in the way I'm presenting this. Oh, so I was saying in our mother, that's where we first experience this oneness. And there's no difference whatsoever. And then we come out and our mind, so our senses, you know, orients the world. Which raises the question, who are we and what are we? And our mind immediately goes to work and, you know, and says, well, you're this and you're this and you're this. And if you do this, you get that. And if you do that, you get this. And the mind shoulders the responsibility of forming and controlling our environments and the way we relate to our environment. And part and parcel of that definition of ourselves is what we can do and what we can't do. And that when we experience fear, we realize that there's something we can't do, and this brings us back to the helplessness, the mortality. And so then our mind makes all these adjustments to try to figure out a way to survive, to have empowerment. However, what we learn is that when we use our mind for the only two things it's good for, which is procreation, right? Everything it takes to procreate. Put food on the table, roof on your head, protect your family, all of that. And focus. To focus. Focus on what? Focus on the here and now. Focus on what's right now. What am I hearing right now? What am I seeing right now? What am I thinking right now? Oh, look at me thinking. There's not a value judgment. It's a totally witnessing without judgment. Just witnessing the existence. Look at me, I'm thinking. Look at me, I'm thinking about how I'm supposed to be thinking. Oh, look at me. Look at me. Oh, my shirt's itching. Oh, look at me. I can hear that police siren. Whatever is here and now. And when we become present, a strange thing happens. We feel at peace. We feel a little more comfort. We feel a little more connected to something. What are we connected to? We're connected to that body of thought of which existence is made. We are in a world of awareness, of consciousness, of thought. A world that we become one with, we find we belong to. And when we experience that belonging, we feel the peace, we feel the relaxation, we feel love. We feel our connectedness to existence or God. Am I confusing you or am
I? No, I'm tracking. I mean, look, I've interviewed a lot of people about what they believe, and some of the stuff that you're saying is some of the stuff other people are saying, and I'm just wondering about how many Gnostic books you've read, because there's a fair bit of Gnosticism in what you're saying.
I wouldn't know. I'm not real good at labels, and what I've read or what I haven't, what I know is what I experience. And
yeah, all I'm saying is it doesn't sound like you've been reading the Hardy Boys.
Well, I did read the Hardy Boys when I was a kid. How did you know?
Yeah, look, all I know is that I feel like writing a bit of an up in your grill letter to Cantor Gitelson and tell him he was very wrong about you.
Yes, well, but you know, we all place so much of our expectations and need for someone to be powerful and parenting in our rabbis and our religious leaders.
Yeah, but this is, I mean, here's a guy who actually, you know, he actually did something you enjoyed during the service, which is, a rare thing for anybody, I think. But, for you, this is the music dude, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
And he writes a letter to you, this guy from your old temple, saying how disappointed he was in you? Really?
Well, because that was his issue. It wasn't me. It was his issue. Of course, at the time, it had an effect on me. But now, looking back on it, that was his thing. That was his problem. He didn't know how to get me in the fold and he felt his helplessness about getting me to be part of. And so he, pointed his finger at me and said, there's something wrong with you. Yeah, what's interesting is we go through life is when we talk to people and experience other people, if we try to suspend our judgment and just try to see helplessness, their helplessness, how they experience their helplessness, how they adjust to it, how they deny it, how they deal with it, how do they deal with it? When we start to become aware of the many, many different manifestations of fear that exist in human behavior that we experience every day in the world we walk through. And the other day I was sitting down and I was watching these people walk by and I started to wonder, I started to think, it's really interesting. If I look for fear in those faces, if I look for it,
yeah,
not as a bad thing,
no, no,
living in it, but just if I look for it, it's easy to see.
Oh, dude, I see that so much. I mean, I know jack about most things. I don't know anything about cars. I don't know. I'm not a handyman repair guy in my nothing. But I'm a creeper. I people watch, and I have looked at and observed people my entire life, and I can smell it before I see it. That sounds a little arrogant. What I'm trying to say is I understand what you're saying. So.
No, you're exactly right. One of the big revelations that I had was when I'd be, with some people or in a situation, and I'd start feeling very anxious, and afterwards I'd go, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Was that me, or was I picking up their fear?
Exactly. No, I totally get that. On the phone with Paul Michael Glaser. Paul, by the way, I mean, I'm looking at the clock, and man, are you okay to keep going? Because this is one of the most enjoyable conversations I've had in at least a day.
Sure, I can go. I can go on, yeah.
I want to ask you, stuff about Elizabeth you may just say, okay, I don't want to talk to you anymore. So just bear with me while I work this out because, the way you speak of Elizabeth makes it seem like she was an angelic superhero. And she must have been a pain in the butt at least once.
I'm surprised to hear you say I speak about her that way because what I'm aware of is saying the opposite. She was a human being. She was not a saint. There is no such thing as a saint unless we think we're all saints. she was a woman whose children and whose own life was threatened, who had a unique gift to be able to focus and organize and motivate and
address Senate.
All of it. Actually, her ability to address anybody was something that she learned to do, in the middle of all of this, because she was not a person who was experienced at all in public speaking or anything like that.
But do you think that the memory of Elizabeth or the impact of everything you went through as a family, because, you didn't just lose your wife, you lost your wife and your daughter. Do you think that that whole thing had any impact on your second marriage? I mean, it must have, but I mean, what I'm trying to awkwardly ask is, do you think that was a huge...
No.
Okay.
No, because after my wife and daughter died, I have a son, and he's HIV positive. And he's, 9 years old or 8 years old, and I've got to take care of him. And I don't know if he's going to live or die, and so I'm petrified, and so I reach out to the first kind of connection I make with somebody, and I get married again.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I was petrified to raise my son by myself. I was not aware of this, but in retrospect, I can see that. So that doesn't mean I didn't love that person or I didn't have an affinity for that person or a connection with that person.
Hmm.
But so much of my motivation was about, my fear and not about light,
right.
Not about going to the light.
Well, I don't know. It just it made me wonder. You know, having seen you in a number of interviews, obviously the Oprah thing. What was it, Super Soul Sunday or something that she had you on?
I have no idea. Oh. My son and I did this thing with, and it was for Oprah.
Yeah. Anyway,
I was trying to get Oprah to read my book. I wanted my book on Oprah. Not my puss.
Right, right. Actually, I saw your boy on some show the other day. It was a few years ago. You know, it was a YouTube video or whatever. Wow, is he a well-spoken young guy? Holy jumping. Is he running the charity now?
No, he should be. He should definitely be running it, but he's not. That's a big, complicated question, which I'm going to dodge. But he has his own organization that he's building called Modern Advocate, which is a really interesting organization that basically advocates for people and advocates for organizations and brings what would be considered disparate entities together with a common, they identify a common goal, a common need, a common value that both entities will benefit from. And they help bring people together. Which is very much of this age and what we're about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So what, Jake's like, what, 31 now?
30 today. No, not today, the 25th. Two more days.
Okay.
One more day.
And our listeners are sitting there going, hold on a second. So Paul Michael Glazer got married. He and his wife had a child, Ariel. Found out a few years later she was HIV positive, that because during the childbirth, I guess, there was blood transfusion, and so Elizabeth contracted AIDS, passed it on to Ariel and Jake. But you and Jake both have CCR5, this, you know, genetic mutation thing that basically means AIDS can't touch you?
Well, no. I think that it's a mutation gene, and I think that was responsible for me not catching.
Not getting it, yeah.
Yeah. Elizabeth. It was responsible for Jake being, he was on medicines for a good part of his childhood. And then he went off medicines and stayed off them for a long time. Until with what research they'd done on this gene, they realized that that time, you know, in your late 20s, the gene doesn't help that much anymore. So he's back on medications, but he's doing very well.
Hmm. What's the last thing you've sketched?
Oh, Jesus.
Jesus. Well, that's a good one. I like that. Was he on the cross?
You asked the question. One of my things, I got into digital painting.
Wow. Isn't that an oxymoron?
No, because when you're painting, you're using a brush, you're using a palette, you're using a knife, you're using all these different tools, right? Well, this is just a different set of tools, but
okay.
You're still painting. You're still creating an image, a visual. And so I don't think it's an oxymoron, but I understand what you're saying, because when I tell people I'm digitally painting, I kind of hear a little bit of a contradiction there, and I think, well, I'm just going to ride over that one. So I had written a second book in between drafts of my first book, which I have not published. I self-published my first book, but unfortunately ran out of money to market it, so I've had to rely on word of mouth. My second book is a rather unusual book, which is also to the child and all of us, and my daughter, Zoe, who's now 17 by my second marriage.
Yeah.
Zoe said, well, why don't you illustrate it? I thought, me? Well, I've always liked to do art, but I've never really taken myself very seriously. So I started messing around with it. Before long, I had 29 illustrations.
Wow.
And then I was in England, Great Britain, for 9 months, doing a tour of Fiddler on the Roof, and I had a lot of time on my hands, so I was doing a lot of digital painting, and I was working on these illustrations, and when I get tired of doing illustrations, I do other things, and I paint other things and other images. And one day, a couple of members of the cast, this couple that were very much in love, and we're going to get married, saw me painting, and they asked if I'd do a drawing for them, a painting for them. And so I did. The musical, we did the musical with acting musicians, so every actor played up to 6 instruments. Not me. But every other, it was amazing to watch them.
And yeah, so, quite a talented ensemble of characters, seriously.
Yeah, it was really incredible. And this couple, the girl played a beautiful saxophone, a tenor sax with a black body and a big silver bell, you know, and the boy played a trumpet. And so I threw together this drawing of the saxophone, and I tilted it back a little bit so that the mouth was pointing up to the sky, and then I brought the trumpet mouth right down on top of it. And they said, oh, this is lovely, thank you very much. And I said, well, I've got to fix it up and make it better for you, because I was starting to really understand that I wanted to work on my art so that I could blow it up. I've done a lot of photography, and I have a lot of photographs that I want to exhibit on a very large scale. And so the big problem with all of this is pixelation, right? Everything breaks up when you make it big.
There's not a lot of people know, I don't think, that... You know, Starsky is this creative, ultra creative guy. I mean, just let me just throw this out, because I just found this out today. The Last Romance opened recently at Broward Stage Door Theater in Florida, and it's being directed by Arthur Whitelaw, who is also he's also directed Jodie Foster and Huckleberry Finn, Liza Minnelli, Christopher Walken, and Bessette van der Kolk, and former Drew Marshall Show guests Gary Berghoff, Kristen Chenoweth, and some guy named Paul Michael Glazer.
Well, he didn't direct me. He produced.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Fire my research staff.
So I'm trying to answer your question about
sketching.
What I last drew. So, you know, when you ask me a question, you're going to get you're going to get my verbosity in toto. So I apologize for that.
You're 71. You've earned it.
I got a long, circuitous route to make my answer. So anyways, I discovered the way to curate my drawings and my paintings in a form that would not break down when I made them bigger. And I bought this equipment to do it, and I've had to learn that equipment. I've had to learn Photoshop, and I've had to learn, you know, and I'm still learning. You can never learn enough of this stuff. And that's the last thing I worked on. I've been working on this painting. They got married in September, and I said, oh, the painting's on its way. they'll like it when it's done. It's a pretty cool piece. I'm really proud of it.
You should send them like a, you know, color by numbers or a crayon project first and say, here it is. And then just mess with their heads. So here we got this live theater guy, goes in for a reading, falls asleep while he's waiting for his turn. He gets woken up and told it's time because you're the last one. And during the audition, cracks some walnuts open, gets the part for this transparent, cliche, sort of beneath him role, and is thankful that it's never going to be a TV series. What do you think one of your heroes, Cary Grant, would have thought of you taking this role as Starsky?
You know, I'm not Cary Grant, but I couldn't make any words come out of my mouth. I literally bumped into him at a party, and I, you know, it's like...
Nice. You turned into Mr. Roper?
Oh, Roper. Is that?
Don Knotts from Three's Company.
Oh, yes, I guess so, yeah. So, anyways, what would he have thought? I don't know, you know, I mean, where did he come out of? Ireland or somewhere over there? He's Cockney, England. And he was a juggler, and he was did vaudeville. And so, in his day and age, you know, making a living was, you know, you took everything that came along. I didn't realize that at the time that I was doing the same thing. You know, he probably would have said, you're an idiot, just do it.
Except he said would have said it with a British accent. You know, I've got a buddy named Phil Serez. One of the four high schools I was asked to leave, Phil and I met, and we played, I hate admitting this to you, we played Starsky and Hutch. So we ran through the hallways shooting each other and throwing each other up against lockers because they made so much noise, but they didn't really hurt, so it looked cool.
Of course.
Yeah, and we'd jump off the roof, you know, rolling along. And I grew up in a funeral home, and we would steal the hearse and pretend we were Starsky and Hutch in the hearse. That's a little weird.
You just kind of threw that out there. You grew up in a funeral home.
Yeah.
How interesting.
So, you know, we tried doing all these crazy stunts that you guys used to do. And I want to know a couple of really important things here. First of all, are you still afraid of heights, you big wuss?
Yeah, I'm not good with heights.
Okay. And
I don't have a problem standing out of an airplane. But as you're asking me to jump four stories, no, I'm not good at that.
Okay. And how are your ankles? Because I'm sure, did you not blow them out because you were wearing those horrible low-cut blue Adidas?
Well, they were the worst. Yeah, I blew out the ligaments a couple of times.
Yeah.
And so...
So who is it? Who is in better shape? I mean, the Aryan blonde or the guy with the Jufro?
The Jufro is in much better shape. I hate to say, my poor friend David is... not well. He's got a lot of issues and a lot of things he's struggling with, and I wish him well.
Well, you can't dance with the bottle that long and not have it kicking the backside, right? So.
Well, you know, he made his choices, but He's a, you know, he's fine. The answer to your question is, what did I say to somebody the other day? I said something about the aches and pains.
About what?
About the aches and pains. You know, every day you move through your life. How old are you?
I am just under 50.
Okay, so, you know, you got a little ways to go.
Yeah.
But when you get there, you'd be fascinated to find, or very discouraged, to find that your daily life is a negotiation. With your failing body.
Yeah.
Which you keep trying to prop up with diet and exercise and rest and, you know. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, you live your life to die, and it's all about letting go and giving up, and your body is saying, we're getting close. We're getting close.
Speaking of Jufros, when they decided to, that's a nice segue, when they decided to do the Starsky and Hutch movie, Ben Stiller, Owen Wilson, your first reaction?
Well, I had actually, David and I had been trying to find a way to do it, to do a movie of Starsky and Hutch, because, you know, we went to 67 countries around the world, and so the opportunity to finance it was definitely there. Hmm. We just had a hard time doing it, and when I heard Warner Brothers had Starsky and Hutch, and they wanted to do it, but they'd been unable to do it, and their option was running out. I called Bill Blinn, who was the, or David rather called him, I think. Yeah, no, I spoke to Bill also. And I shared with him an idea for doing a remake. And he loved the idea. And he said, oh, great, let's do it. When's the option? About a couple of weeks. Well, in a couple of weeks, Warner Brothers basically informed Bill Blinn that they were going to buy the rights outright, and they weren't going to take an option. They're just going to buy it,
right?
And, because Ben was interested in doing it. So I met Ben, and he was lovely, and he was, you know, really nice. And I said, "Well, what do you want to do? Do you want to do a spoof? Do you want to do something funny, or do you want to?" go after all of the emotions and try to find a relationship.
You mean like the original Starsky and Hutch?
Yeah. And he said he wanted to do the latter.
Yeah.
But he had a director who wanted to do the former.
Uh-oh.
And so that didn't materialize for him. But we spent a day on the set, David and I, we did some work. And, you know, Berman's very talented. He's a really good mind. And he caught a lot of aspects of me. And Owen is delightful. And so, you know, when people make a movie or something you've done that because it became iconic,
yeah,
you know, all you can do is appreciate the compliment and move on.
You know, John Schneider told me one time that without question, the General Lee would have outmuscled the Gran Torino, a.k.a. the Striped Tomato, easily.
Oh, John's full of shit. And you can tell him I said, well, it might very well have. You know, the Torino, the thing that we had was really a piece of crap. Not a very good car.
I heard that that David really loved it when you took sharp corners and he was able to spoon you. Because it was it was a bench seat, right?
Slide into my lap.
I bet you it was easier to corner than the hearse I used to drive around in.
Oh, boy, I bet that hearse was top-heavy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What are your top three eye roll questions you continually get asked about the whole Starsky thing? And I'm gonna guess the first one, and then you throw down on the others. But it's got to be the sweater comment. Really? You want to know about the sweater? You want to know about the sweater I bought in Alvarado Street in L.A.? Really?
Right. That could easily be one of the questions. The other question is, are you Starsky or Hutch?
Oh, no. No, you've not been asked that.
Oh, I got nickels for every time.
Well, like over in Japan or something? I mean, I played over there, too.
No, that was one of the most frequent questions.
Jeez.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, that's pretty
good. Well, I'd either say I'm both.
Yeah.
Or I'd say take your pick.
Or I'm David Michael Soul.
Or I'm David Michael Soul. I could have said that, too.
Well, I mean, it's just been, like, what a run. What a run.
It ain't over yet.
Yeah, sorry. It sounded like I was delivering your eulogy there. Sorry about that, but.
That's okay. Maybe you know something I don't. As far as I can tell, I'm still here.
I really wish you the best.
Oh, thank you.
I find you a heck of a lot deeper than I thought you might be. It's a great compliment, isn't it? I said to one girl one time, you know, for a fat girl, you don't sweat much. I thought that was a compliment.
Yeah, well, you know, guys can say that to guys, but if you said that to a girl,
nah.
You'd get slapped.
Yeah, it's not good. No. I, my son and I, he's 25, we come up with the best backhanded compliments, you know, stuff like, wow, you didn't eat near as much as I thought you would.
Negative compliment.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. I really appreciate your time. I appreciate the fact that you have processed things that so many people don't. The first part of this interview gave me a headache, but I'm really glad we went there because I have to force myself to peel away the layers to get down to the level that you live and breathe every day.
You don't have to force yourself. You should just trust your survival instincts. And I can tell by the level of your questions, your survival instinct and your curiosity will take care of you just fine. So, you know, if God forbid, you or not God forbid, God, you know, to me, it's an opportunity. To me, it's the opportunity to grow is everything. And so it may happen that something happens in your life or something doesn't, but you're obviously a learner and you're a student, and that's what I am, and that's what you got to be in order to be able to grow.
Folks, Paul Michael Glaser has been our guest today on the Drew Marshall Show, and I don't think I can suck up anymore. I like him. PaulMichaelGlaser.org is the website you want to go to find out all things about this guy, including his book, which people can they go to the website and buy the book, or do we have, like, where can we get this?
No, well, you can, but it's easier to get it on Amazon.
Right.
You can get an autographed version of the book if you go to Cristalia.com. That's spelled, by the way, CHRYSTALLIA, Crystallia.com. But if you go on Amazon, you can get the book, and you can also, as I said at the start, there's a recorded version, which I did. I'm very proud of.
Brilliant. I really appreciate it. And again, folks, let me just throw this final plug in. The book is about faith, it's about hope, and it's about fear. And if you're not into those three things, then what are you doing listening to my show?
It's a really fun story. I mean, there's a lot of fun stuff in the book, you know, a lot of good humor and whimsy, and it's a good story. Yeah.
I can't wait for you to contact Cameron and get the Avatar thing going on this.
Yes. Someday, although my editor once said to me, she was a brilliant woman, she said, Paul, this is a really important book. It's going to be big. It may not be in your lifetime.
Thank you. That's nice. That's nice.
So there you go.
Paul Michael Glazer, thank you. I really appreciate your time, sir.
Oh, my pleasure. You stay well.
Thanks, man. Take care.
Take care.
Bye.
It's hard to find quality guest speakers these days. If they're interesting, they're usually expensive. And if they're cheap, they're usually boring. Well, here's someone who's both expensive and boring. Drew Marshall is a high school dropout who tried to become a pro football player but didn't make it. He then tried to become a firefighter and didn't make it. Now he's trying to become a stand-up comic. Good luck with that, Mr. Marshall. But if you're looking for someone who's unpredictable, incredibly honest, provocative, genuine, then we've got the right guy. Everyone seems to be an expert on something these days. Why not book someone who's an expert on nothing, except how to be brutally honest about yourself and your faith? To book Drew Marshall as your guest speaker, go to drewmarshall.ca.